get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam. A charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam. A charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
This is continuing coverage.
The Black Swan murder trial of Ashley Benefield from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Now back to the courtroom.
Imposing a duty to retreat from the home may adversely impact victims of domestic violence. Although the state argues that nothing has changed in the intervening years since Bobbitt to require us to recede from that decision, to the contrary, much has changed in the public policy of this state based on increased knowledge about the plight of domestic violence victims. It is now widely recognized that domestic violence, quote, attacks are often repeated over time, and escape from the home is rarely possible without the threat of great personal violence or death, unquote. Imposition of the duty to retreat on a battered woman who finds herself the target of a unilateral, unprovoked attack in her own home is inherently unfair. During repeated instances of past abuse, she has retreated only to be caught, dragged back inside, and severely beaten again. If she manages to escape, other hurdles confront her. Where will she go if she has no money, no transportation, and her children are left behind in the care of an enraged man? What the duty to retreat exception means to a battered woman is that as long as it is a stranger who attacks her in her home, she has a right to fight back and labors under no duty to retreat. If the attacker is her husband or live-in partner, however, she must retreat. Studies show that women who retreat from the residence when attacked by their co-occupant, spouse, or boyfriend may in fact increase the danger of harm to themselves due to the possibility of attack after separation. According to Dr. Lenore Walker, quote, the batterer would often rather kill or die himself than separate from the battered woman, unquote. Experts in the field explain that separation or retreat can be the most dangerous time in the relationship for the victims of domestic violence because, quote, violence increases dramatically when a woman leaves an abusive relationship, unquote. A leading expert in the
Mr.
field...
Taylor, I got to stop you. You're going to have to... You're reading and reading and reading. Please tell me how this relates to the state's request that I order your expert to provide a proffer before he can testify. Well, I'm not seeing the connection.
I think this, what the state is arguing, and this is the reason why I told the court's already ruled on this, what the state's arguing is that the expert should not be allowed to testify.
No, they're asking for a proffer ahead of time. That's it.
Yeah. But there is no provision for such
And I'm ready to make a ruling when everybody is done.
I'm done.
But I just, if you want to keep going, that's fine, but I'm going to need to understand the relevance of the quotes that you're reading me from that Florida Supreme Wyand case to understand how that plays into your arguments against the state's request for a proffer. I'm not understanding.
It doesn't. It goes to the broader issue if the court was reconsidering it. I did not know whether or not the expert should be allowed to testify. Oh. And it speaks to their perception of domestic violence and what should be authorized. But I hear the court.
All right. If we get to that bridge, I'll let you cross it.
All right.
Okay. I am searching for the right words. My level of confusion as to what both sides are doing and arguing is about pegged. Multiple times throughout multiple hearings, including on July 11th of 2024, Mr. Taylor and the defendant have emphatically stated this is not a battered spouse syndrome case. I've heard that multiple times, and I specifically pick the hearings we had on July 11th on other matters because it came up right at the end about the deposition of the expert, Mr. Ferris, was coming up. And Ms. O'Donnell had said, I don't have a transcript, this is from my memory, Ms. O'Donnell had raised an objection that if Mr. Ferris was going to talk about, or he was a battered spouse syndrome expert, the required notice under the rule had not been given. And Mr. Taylor said again that this is not a battered spouse syndrome case. And so I left the courtroom on July 11th saying, okay, this is not a battered spouse syndrome case. We'll see what happens at the deposition. The very next day on June 12th at 4:33 p.m., the defense files notice of intent to rely upon battered spouse syndrome defense. And I looked at the notice of intent, and it complies with the rule. It gives the required notice. It talks about what evidence is going to be used to support the battered spouse syndrome defense. It provides the essential facts upon which the defense is going to rely. It provides a list of witnesses, including G. Bruce Eric Ferris, as witnesses who are going to support the battered spouse syndrome defense. And I don't recall if it was at that hearing or another hearing, we had a fairly in-depth discussion about the case law, including Okindo and the differences between PTSD and reasonable person, and how battered spouse syndrome can be used in a stand your ground or a self-defense situation. But the emphasis was still, this is not a battered spouse case.
Judge, in fairness, I footnoted that.
I'm confused there. On the state side, I've looked at the state's motion in limine to request a proffer of expert testimony. What I don't see in here is authority for that, where I can order the other side, you will give me a proffer of your witness's testimony for me to make a decision. I've made decisions based on a transcript that's been provided to me on discrete areas that may or may not be admissible. What this screams out to me, and I have no idea why we're not doing it, is a Daubert hearing that certainly one side or the other can move for a pretrial ruling on the admissibility of scientific or technical evidence under 90.702 and the federal Daubert standard, where all of these issues, the qualifications of the expert, what they relied on, are those sources reliable? Did they apply reasonable and scientific methods? I mean, all the, I don't have the predicate in front of me, but that's where that hearing would be. Ask for a Daubert hearing, the other side needs to comply. So I don't consider today a Daubert hearing. This is just a straight motion in limine where I haven't heard from the expert. I haven't heard I don't have any facts in front of me about the Daubert factors or 90.702 factors. I haven't even been provided a copy of his transcript. So I don't know why we didn't do that. Next, my confusion is we discussed Hixon at a prior hearing. And it talks about the, as reflected in the rule, and I think, if I remember correctly, Hixon was a Florida Supreme Court decision that predated this rule and essentially laid out the framework of what eventually became Rule 3.201, I think it is, the batter spouse rule. And so Hixon kind of laid that out and fleshed out within the Rules Committee, turned into the actual rule that was then subsequently approved by the rulemaking process. And what Hixon talks about is if it's a battered spouse case, and the rule as well, and the expert interviews the defendant, then the state has every right to get its own expert to do its own evaluation of the defendant. Now, what I've heard is apparently Mr. Ferris, during his interview or during his deposition, said he interviewed the defendant for several, and I'm just relying on representations now, I have not seen it with my own eyes, interviewed the defendant for several hours. There was some initial veracity or some initial interview. I don't know how long that was, but then there were two subsequent interviews after he was retained for this case. On the flip side, if the expert does not evaluate the defendant and is going to just speak about general, non-specific traits, which is what I've been hearing for the defense, it's going to be very general, it's been going to be very non-specific. There was talk from the defense about there's going to be hypotheticals posed, but I will say that in the back of my mind I was always wondering what those hypotheticals were going to be, if they were going to be very generic and non-specific, and then those hypotheticals started bringing in the facts of this case, how that would play out, but here nor there, that'll be a decision to be made later. But in this situation, what I'm hearing is the expert evaluated the defendant twice. And I only say this, this has nothing to do with my ruling on whether I'm going to order a proffer or not. It just goes to my, I want to just flesh out the issues of my confusion about, is this battered spouse, is it not? What part of Hixon are we talking about? Is there been an evaluation? There's going to be hypotheticals and opinions expressed based upon the facts of this case? Or is this just going to be a very generic, he hasn't interviewed her, it's going to be a very generic discussion about domestic violence victims? We all know what brackish water is. I don't think Hixon allows for some kind of brackish presentation here. It's either batter spouse syndrome, and there was an evaluation, and the state has a right to do its own expert evaluation, or there was no evaluation, and it's purely generic information and hypotheticals. I say all of that with, just so you guys have the walking away knowledge of, we're less than a week from trial, and I am so confused. Is this a batter spouse syndrome case or not? I keep hearing it is, I keep hearing it isn't. I've heard everything I'm going to hear. I mean, I gave you both multiple opportunities to tell me. You just need to know, I still don't know where we're at. But my answer is this. I don't think there's any, I can't think of any provision under the law, I'm not aware of any authority under the rules that would allow me, and I haven't been provided any case law authority that gives me the discretion to say, defense, you will proffer your expert testimony. It's usually the opposite, right? That somebody wants to put something in, I have an objection, I rule it's out, and the defense or the state will proffer it so it's in the record. And of course, that proffer is, if you read the appellate court decisions on that, this is why it's so important for the proponent to get that proffer in, because it gives the trial court that opportunity to hear the evidence and hear the questions and hear the cross and make a ruling that avoids trial court error. So, with that lengthy explanation, the state's request for the court to order the defendant to provide a proffer is denied.
May I assist, Your Honor, on two brief points?
If it's on that, I'm done. I've made my ruling. So I'm sure it'll come up again based upon my expression of concerns. But I've been asked to rule on the proffer, and I've ruled on the proffer. State's motion to quash.
That was already.
Oh, that was.
That was withdrawn.
No. Oh, that's right. The. I'm sorry. I was reading for the notice of hearing.
Okay.
Defendant's motion request for clarification of court's amended omnibus order and incorporated memo of law filed July 10th, 2024. Sir, whenever you're ready.
Let me start by asking the court, rather than going through everything, if the court has any specific questions it would want me to address, or would it prefer I just present my position? We sought clarification of the court's conclusion in the omnibus order that the admissions of Douglas Benefield under oath at a deposition to shooting the gun in the house and punching the dog, rendering the dog unconscious, and punching holes in the walls of the house, as well as one other one, I believe, putting a tracker on the car, if I'm not mistaken.
That was not covered.
Let's see, paragraph 3, I set it out. I'm sorry, throwing a loaded gun at Ms. Benefield. We sought to have that admissible, and the court, in its omnibus order, we cited several reasons why it would be admissible. The court, in its omnibus order, ruled that it did not qualify those admissions as statements against interest, but the court gave no reason why it would not qualify as a statement against interest. So we asked for qualification on that point, and we presented, Your Honor, with case law, but first attempted to remind the court that at the Stand Your Ground hearing, the testimony established that Ms. Benefield was the victim of these events, that they were driven at and for Ms. Benefield. The court, we felt, precluded finding those admissions as statements against interest because of the predicate requirement that Ms. Benefield know about the incidents. And what we are saying to the court is, obviously, she was present for the firing of the gun into the ceiling of the home, as acknowledged by Mr. Benefield in the admission, and his statement that he did it to shut her up, to make her stop talking. As far as throwing the gun at Ms. Benefield, he acknowledged that as well. Additionally, punching the dog in the face, he acknowledged Ms. Benefield was present. Some of the witnesses in the proceeding made the same acknowledgement, like Tommy Benefield, for example. And finally, Your Honor, punching numerous holes in the drywall of the home, there were acknowledgments of that as well. So we sought and we seek a basis for the court's conclusion that these acts, and specifically those admissions, do not qualify as statements against interest. And we cited, among other things, Bearden versus State, which is a state Supreme Court decision, where they held that the credibility of an in-court witness who is testifying as to an out-of-court declaration against penal interest is not a matter for the trial court's consideration in determining whether to admit the testimony. Instead, the jury has the duty to assess the credibility of the in-court witness. The reason we pointed that out is because it's not clear from Your Honor's ruling. The court ruled that the deposition admissions could not be used as substantive evidence. The court did not say that it could not be used for impeachment purposes of a witness. And there is a vast difference between the two. And we cited case law to show the court that. So, for example, if I
also added alone, if you look at page 2 of 9 of the amended order, thus, the court's ruling in this order addresses only those specific acts argued during the hearing, A, B, C, and G, and the admission of the victim's deposition testimony alone as substantive evidence to prove the alleged prior acts of violence and aggression. So it was made in a vacuum. The defense had represented, we have all this other evidence that we're going to present, but the only thing that was presented to me, and so I'm not going to go out on a limb and say, well, if you introduce this, this, and this, then I'll allow this. I'm presented with facts, and I make rulings. So my ruling was that standing alone, A, B, C, and G are not admissible as substantive evidence.
Okay, I read that sentence more times than I can count. And I was not sure, and that was why we filed the clarification, whether or not the court was including in that statement, and I based my position on the motion filed by the state in limine that the court granted. I was not sure if the court was going to preclude me from being able to ask the question on cross-examination, are you aware that Douglas Benefield made these admissions? And that was where I sought the clarification. Because the court, in its preliminary order on the state's motion in limine, pretty clearly said that it would not allow such cross-examination. If I'm wrong, then we're good. If I'm right, then I filed this to show the court that I believe my position is correct, and I cited the court's specific case law allowing such cross-examination. I might remind Your Honor, without getting out of order, in that motion in limine that the state filed, the court also granted, as a preliminary conclusion, precluding the defense from asking a witness such as Justin Warren, the lead homicide detective, the difference between justified homicide and murder. Of course, the relevance to this case is that Ms. Benefield is charged with murder and her defense is justified. The court, to my surprise, granted the state's motion. I have cited the court's specific case law allowing such questions. I also explained to the court that the jury instructions are going to require the court to charge that and explain justifiable homicide as opposed to murder to the jurors. Dr. Vega, at the Stand Your Ground hearing, explained the difference between justifiable, excusable homicide and murder. There's no reason why the defense, in establishing their position, cannot do so at the first opportunity, and that might be the cross-examination of Dr. Vega. But if I'm precluded from asking that question, I obviously cannot do that. And I cited the court's specific case law showing that that was appropriate and relevant. So again, we saw clarification on that issue. I also cited to the court the Bearden case, and the reason I cited the Bearden case is because in there, the Florida Supreme Court, citing the Chambers case, which I previously briefed for the court and gave the court a memoranda, noted that corroborative evidence is admissible to strengthen a witness's testimony by evidence of matters showing its consistency and reasonableness, intending to indicate that the facts probably were as stated by the witness. Again, being precluded from cross-examining into these areas, specifically matters that will corroborate Ms. Benefield's defense, I believe to be an improper restriction of Ms. Benefield's right to cross-examine. And to my surprise, the court also granted in the state's motion in limine, unless the defense was able to demonstrate relevance, that I could not question Detective Warren about his removal from the arrest affidavit various material aspects, such as taking out the witness Barbara Russell and or Douglas Benefield. And I cited case law to Your Honor in this motion specifically showing what an improper restriction that would be on Ms. Benefield's right to cross-examine, that any time a witness takes the stand, their credibility is an issue. And I also cited, Your Honor, a federal case only because I thought that their statement about the scope of cross-examination was pretty poignant. in U.S. versus Skelton, the Fifth Circuit case, the court noted, while the scope of cross-examination is within the discretion of the trial judge, this discretionary authority to limit cross-examination comes into play only after there has been permitted, as a matter of right, sufficient cross-examination to satisfy the Sixth Amendment. In Tansey versus State, a Florida case, 3rd DCA, I cited for the court because of their holding that our evidence code liberally permits the introduction of evidence to show the bias or motive of a witness. Included within the types of matters that demonstrate bias are those that relate to the interests of the witness, favoritism, and corruption. So here's what we have in this case. And I know that the court didn't appreciate it. Bias against women is endemic to America's institutions.
Did you just say I didn't appreciate something?
I'm sorry?
Did you just say I didn't appreciate something?
I don't know if that's what I said.
Hold on, I'll tell us. I'll check. So here's what we have in this case, and I know the court didn't appreciate it. Biased against women is endemic to America's institution.
Yeah, I'm getting
ready. So what do I not appreciate?
I'm getting ready to tie in what the court didn't appreciate. I footnoted in my notice of battered spouse syndrome that it wasn't traditional battered spouse syndrome, because traditional is the woman is still in the home. In this case, she was not still in the home. All right? But bias against women is endemic to all our institutions. And what we have in the testimony of Justin Warren is my opportunity to show that that bias was at stake. And the court is prohibiting me from the granting of its motion in limine that the state filed from questioning Detective Warren.
I'm sorry, point out in my amended omnibus order where I said you may not do that?
You granted the state's motion and said that until such time as I show it is relevant.
Ah, so I didn't say no. I said any impeachment
correct.
Must be relevant and material.
Correct.
And okay.
I have filed this clarification to show the court that it is both relevant and material, and that's why I cited this case law. I don't want to be in a position, Your Honor, where my cross-examination throughout the trial is methodically interrupted by either an objection from the state, or we have to send the jury in and out on multiple occasions, because that's going to create, it's not only going to render my examination less effective, it's going to create animus. I don't know if the jury's animus, I don't know where it's going to be directed. I only know that I'm here with an obligation to defend Ms. Benefield to the best of my ability. And under the case law, such a cross-examination of the lead detective is clearly relevant and material. So I have filed this clarification so that we could get past that. That's the purpose of this. I attached to my motion an excerpt from the deposition of Detective Justin Warren, wherein he says all homicides are murders and all who kill are murderers. Now, to me, Your Honor, that is clearly a bias. And it makes me wonder what chance Ms. Benefield had in the mind of Detective Warren when he was already describing this as a murder less than 45 minutes after the shooting, when he was drawing up his first search warrant. That is indicative of bias. I am allowed to probe that detective on cross-examination to show that his decision was motivated by bias. Whether or not I'm successful is a separate collateral issue. That'll be up to the jury. But the court, nonetheless, provisionally granted the state's motion in limine. Again, I filed this clarification so that we could get past that, especially given the fact that self-defense is Ms. Benefield's defense. And if you have a lead detective saying that all homicides or murders, it's not only a complete misstatement of the law, but it clearly shows bias. According to him, the 90-year-old motorist who has a diabetic incident while he's driving his car and hits and kills a pedestrian is a murderer. And the fact of the matter is, under the law, that would be an excusable homicide, assuming no drugs or anything else was at play. The court is provisionally restricting me from questioning the detective about that. That shows bias. It's a fair inquiry on behalf of Ms. Benefield, and I should clearly be allowed to make that inquiry, and I think the court restricting me from doing it is an impermissible preclusion of Ms. Benefield's right of cross-examination. That's my position, Your Honor.
State?
Judge, I would just say this is not a motion to clarify. This is a motion to state everything I've already stated that the court has already ruled on, and I think your order is clear. Thank you.
Mr. Taylor, rebuttal?
No.
All right. After I reviewed the defendant's motion, request for clarification of the court's amended omnibus order, I read it as a motion for rehearing. I reviewed it carefully to see if there was any legal points or factual points that weren't addressed or needed clarifying. I will note that the state had filed a motion for clarification, and as I reviewed my prior order, I did notice that I had neglected to put the actual legal ruling in and the basis for that. However, I've had a chance to review the amended omnibus order, and I don't think it needs clarification, and quite frankly, I find that the request for clarification is really a motion for rehearing, and I'm going to deny it. We have two things left, the jury questionnaires and the request for paralegal to remain at counsel table. But I have a plea at 11 o'clock, and I don't see, did Ms. Glenn come in? Not yet? All right, I've got a plea at 11 o'clock, so I'll need to take a little bit of a break. I think it's negotiated. Are you covering?
No.
I don't even have the state here for it. All right, we'll just keep going.
Judge, I think there's a third issue, unless perhaps I misunderstood the court's earlier response denying the proffer of the expert. I have also moved to exclude the amended discovery that they sent, designating Kimberly Griffin as an expert and her CPT notes and her testimony.
Did you file a motion? Did you file a motion?
Response.
Oh, in the response.
Yes. And in the alternative, if the court did not grant it, I asked for a Daubert hearing. Now, my response was late because the state's amended discovery was late. My response was immediately following that. Doesn't have a copy, I'll share my copy as long as
bear with me, and it might be in the court file too, but bear with me. Kelly had also made a separate pile. Okay, interesting, Kim. I apologize. I don't see that. If you tell me when was that filed, I can just pull it up, so I don't want to take your copy.
150. Oh.
Well, if the court, after it's 11 o'clock, wants to just make a copy, that's fine, Your Honor.
Actually, yeah, let me take a look at it real quick. Because the last thing in the court file is from July 11th. Response to states... I'm sorry. Yes, I do have that. Thank you, Deputy. All right, let's see if we can get through that before the 11 o'clock shows up. All right, and this is going to be... All right, so this is coming from the defendant's response to state's request for a proffer of defense expert. And state supplemental amended discovery notice, or in the alternative, demand for Daubert hearing and incorporated memo of law. And this is referring to the state's listing of, you said, Kimberly Griffin.
Yes, sir.
All right, go ahead, sir.
Alleviate some of the argument if I just say I do not anticipate Kim Griffin testifying as an expert.
Your Honor, on Friday the 12th, the court, on Friday the 12th, the state filed notice of discovery listing Kimberly Griffin as an expert witness. Ms. Griffin, so that the court knows, is the CPT representative who acted as a coordinator in this case. And as soon as we got that, I started to compose the response, which is before the court. So our objection is twofold. Well, threefold, actually. Number one, this is a very, very late filing, especially for an expert witness that the state now seeks to introduce. Secondly, we are extremely troubled by the fact that, and we don't think this... Respectfully, Judge White is subject to dispute. CPT information is confidential. It is not subject to dissemination. We gave the court an earlier memoranda on that, but to make it easy for the court, I gave the court a synopsis of that in this response. There is no exception under which Ms. Griffin, on behalf of the child protection team, is allowed to disseminate this material, to talk about it, or to rely upon any of the written information and documents. In addition to that, Your Honor, there is nothing about the Department of Children and Families, as well as the child protection team, that rises to the level of the necessity of expert testimony. Even assuming if the court were to allow similar testimony to be heard, and again, I refer the court to the earlier memoranda that we filed directing confidentiality of both DCF and CPT. But even if it were to be admissible, there's nothing that the jury needs an expert to explain what an allegation of child abuse is. That's pretty clear. And finally, Your Honor, and I'm giving the court a nutshell in light of the court's schedule, if the court somehow gets past all of that, we've asked for a Daubert hearing because there is absolutely nothing about the machinations inherent in CPT that is subject to a Daubert analysis. And as this court knows, it has a gatekeeping function and the burden is upon the state. But I can tell the court with pretty good certainty there are no empirical studies that Ms. Griffin is going to bring to this court to try to justify under Daubert findings of the CPT team. So with that, Your Honor, unless the court has any questions, that's our position.
I got a ton of questions, but I don't think they're for you. State.
Yes.
Before you get started.
Yes.
Who is Kimberly Griffin? How is she an expert? What is she? Hold on. I know you just what you just said before Mr. Taylor spoke, but she's been designated as an expert. What is she an expert on? What's she going to testify about? Has she been disposed? When was she known about? The discovery deadline in this case, pursuant to the stipulation signed by you for this trial period, gave a discovery deadline of 31 days before trial. I calculate that using the rules of general practice and judicial administration, what is it, 2505? At June 21st of 2024, it's my understanding she was listed on July 12th, well past. My mind is just swimming with questions.
Okay. Judge, she was disclosed in the discovery that went out in 2021. Her initial reports, it's voluminous, it's in the discovery. What was omitted unintentionally was her name from the witness list. But the defense has had numerous reports of Kim Griffin. She is a coordinator at CPT, and she was involved in some of the previous allegations, the investigation of some of the previous allegations against Doug Benefield.
All right. So her reports went out.
Yes.
Related to some CPT or CPS investigation.
Yes.
But she wasn't listed.
Correct. Her name was not listed. It was an inadvertent mistake. I actually thought her name was listed all this time. I went back to look and realized that there was someone else named Kim, first name Kimberly or Kim, and that must have been why I thought she was listed. So I immediately, and this was on June 3rd, or when I spoke to Ms. Griffin in preparation for trial, she indicated to me that she had some typed notes. So I immediately gave those to the defense, and that was on the 3rd of July. Those notes were not in my possession until the 3rd of July, but they basically pretty much reiterate what's already in the documents that were already given over to the defense. Still at this point, I thought her name was on the witness list. It wasn't until I realized my mistake on the 12th that she was actually listed as a witness, you know, on the witness list. So, yes, her name was listed late. She has been a part of this discovery. Her reports have been in discovery. It's not like she is a new, unexpected witness. I think everyone knew about her all along. And it was an inadvertent mistake that she was not.
But I wouldn't know, putting myself in the shoes of Mr. Taylor, how do I know? Is she A, B, or C? So I get these reports. You don't list her. That tells me she doesn't have information related to this matter. You give me these reports. She's not listed as A, B, or C, telling me that, hey, she has information, and I can depose her, or no, she's off limits. I can't depose her.
I would assume that the defense would not know, Judge. But the state is obligated to list every witness that is listed in discovery. So technically, every witness whose name shows up in discovery should be listed in discovery, and her name, by virtue of not being there, is an indication that there was a mistake, because it should have been in there to begin.
Or she's not relevant. She has no information related to the matter.
Okay. And that may be true. But
I'm just saying, if we're going to make assumptions, there's other assumptions that could fit that scenario.
Yes. As an aside, this witness is available for deposition and can be deposed this week. I just deposed Barbara Russell on Friday. So we are continuing discovery right up until trial. It's not unusual. While I wish this had not happened and I wish I had listed her name earlier, I think it is there is a remedy, and that if the defense would like to depose her, I anticipate her testimony is only going to mirror what is in her reports. So it's no new information. She would not be testifying as an expert. The word expert is next to her name because in our system, typically when she is listed in child abuse cases, when she testifies in child abuse cases, she is an expert forensic interviewer. So she's listed as an expert at the state attorney's office, but she did not conduct a forensic interview in this case. So her testimony would be non-expert testimony, pure factual, based on the information that came in and what transpired after that.
All right. So this is one of those situations where going from practitioner to judge becomes so pronounced. You guys have been living this case for almost 4 years now. So when you tell me it's in her notes, her testimony is going to mirror what's in her reports, that means something to you all. It means zero to me. What is she going to testify about? She's a fact witness. What does she know about the homicide that occurred on whatever day it was, September 27th of 2020. I mean, how is she relevant?
She will testify about the previous reports, how we had
There was a deputy that testified.
Detective Moreland testifying about the criminal aspect.
And I limited what he could say.
Exactly. And her testimony would be similar, the child protection end of it, but also limited in what she can say. But that would be the information that she would testify about.
Right. Is it the same incidents?
Yes.
Right, because it gets reported, 1-800-96-ABUSE, calls made, goes, it gets routed to CPS or CPT. I still get confused about who's what and who's who.
Right.
Ms. Glynn, I'm just going to do this for real quick, and then we're going to take your plea.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not going to make you wait.
No problem.
Thank you.
I got time.
It gets routed there. It may just stay in the, I say DP world, because the dependency cases, right? Maybe it just stays with CPS or MSO, their child protective team. Maybe there's also a criminal investigation, so it could open a CF or an MM case.
Right.
It could also turn into a DP, a dependency case. And then, of course, all of those things could then also be part of a DR case.
Right.
And we have some of that here. I guess my question is, I think I already made the ruling over the defendant's objection that I would allow Detective Moreland to testify at the trial, essentially what I allowed at the Stand Your Ground here.
Yes.
And now you're saying, and we want another person to come in and testify about those exact same things.
Judge, it's from a different angle. It is from the child protection team angle, and as Your Honor just said, they're two very different, they have different goals, they have different jobs. And so I think it's important that the same thing happened in two different agencies that have different goals. The detective is talking solely about criminal charges. CPT and CPS is speaking specifically about DR cases or, you know, dependency cases. So it's for two very different reasons that they're doing each doing evaluations. And the fact that neither law enforcement nor the family realm proceeded with charges or cases. I think it's important to differentiate between the criminal world and the family world, and that is two different sectors and that they could do two different things, and neither one of them did.
But I still never got this clear answer. There was a DP case. Was there a dependency?
Yes.
Which, again, I've already put all of my questions about that are still unanswered. All right, let me go ahead and take a break. I do want to be respectful of Ms. Glenn's time and take this plea, because she did have 11 o'clock booked. So why don't you guys take about a 15-minute break? I'll take the plea, and then we'll get right back to it with your rebuttal, Mr. Taylor. Are you going to take this, or do you want me to call? Okay. Yeah, are you calling digital? Thank you so much. Thank you very much. All right, we are back. 3014. Again, I appreciate your indulgence as I took that plea. I know there's been multiple hearings that we've had where I've had to interrupt your guys' flow. It's just the nature of a busy criminal division, so I appreciate you being flexible. Before I go to Mr. Taylor, a couple more questions for the state. If this is getting into your work product privilege, I certainly understand, but I'm going to ask my questions anyway. You know me, if you say you're not comfortable answering because it's privileged, that's absolutely fine, because I don't think you are required to divulge trial strategy and so forth. What did you... All right, first, was Ms. Griffin the investigator on the... I'm just going to say CPS, the CPS... investigations.
Yes.
Or were you going to seek for her to go beyond what I allowed Detective Moreland to testify to?
I would not say go beyond, but I think her, the things that she looks at, and she had contact with the defendant at times, you know, there are different aspects that she was involved in. But ultimately, no, nothing other than some version of no charges were filed, whatever it is in that realm.
If I remember correctly, I allowed Detective Moreland to say who he was, that he'd been and his experience and so forth. And correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it was the date that a complaint was received, the essential nature of the complaints, that an investigation was completed, a criminal investigation was completed, and then no charges were filed.
Correct.
What beyond that, adapting those questions and answers to the CPS-CPT realm, were you seeking to get in?
Nothing, other than adapting it to that realm.
Are there any defendant statements that Ms. Griffin was going to testify to?
No, not to my knowledge. Other than, I would have to look at, again, at the reports that were provided to make sure if there were any statements. They have been provided if there were.
I forget, whose motion is this?
The defense.
It's yours, so I'm coming back to you for rebuttal. So this is my only chance with you.
Okay.
I'd like to say it's my last question, but you never know with me. My final question would be this. If you could address the 403 issue that I'm thinking about, and that being that the probative value of Kim Griffin's testimony is substantially outweighed by the danger of needless presentation of cumulative evidence, confusion of the issues, and misleading of the jury on this point. It's my understanding that, and I seem to recall there were four cases that Brian Moreland testified about.
Yes.
All right. Each one of those generated from a singular phone call or a singular report. And for my purposes, I'm just going to say phone call. You know, just assume all four of them were 1-800-96-ABUSE, although it doesn't have to happen like that. And then from there, you have a CPS investigation. That's one branch, which then could lead into, it stops there, or it could lead into the child protection team. Also then branch off from there to a dependency, which would be Department of Children and Families. Could also have criminal charges, and as I said, the domestic relations. I used CFMMDP and DR previously to help me keep the case type straight. Would it not be misleading to the jury to allow Detective Moreland to testify about these four incidents and the criminal investigations, and allow Ms. Griffin to testify about her four investigations, even with the, I'll call it, throttled down information or limited information that I'm allowing with Detective Moreland? Can you address my concern that that may mislead the jury that, hey, with under your theory that Ms. Benefield is the one that made these calls to advance her self-interest, well, now it's sort of misleading. Were there eight reports, but there were only four?
And that would not be the intent of the state. It would be to address it as though they were four calls, and this is what law enforcement did, and this is what the CPS side of it did. And in neither one did the defendant get the satisfaction that she was looking for, either because, and I do not believe it's cumulative because it's two different aspects. It's criminal and family, and neither the family realm nor the criminal realm gave the defendant what she was seeking. And I think it's fair for the state to put on each of those realms to say, yes, we investigated, we did what we normally do, and we did not go forward.
All right. Thank you, ma'am. Was that everything?
Yes.
I didn't want to cut you off. All right, Mr. Taylor.
More continuing coverage is on the way.
The Black Swan murder trial of Ashley Benefield from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Press subscribe now.
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam. A charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam. A charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam. A charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.